Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 512 with my guest Joe List. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit rattling around in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. I'm not a therapist, and this is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling, but it is meant to give you a place to sit and think about why the fuck we're still alive. Is that a little too heavy? It is a heavy, heavy week. This is November 5th. It's 2 days after the election. Still haven't decided who is going to fuck up our country. And I need to know. I need to know who is going to be the final nail in Rome's coffin. Oh, I've been binge watching that stuff about the Nexium cult. There's actually two of them, one on HBO called Vow and another one on Stars called Seduced. And I finished the one on HBO, and I, without spoiling anything for anybody who hasn't watched it, it's about a guy that wants to bring volleyball to prisons in a roundabout way. And it poses a lot of questions, you know. Is someone considered criminally insane if they have unlimited resources and still choose to live in Albany? What's it like as a young woman growing up in the shadow of a famous mother with half an accent? Who should be held responsible for a cult's musical numbers? Should we be afraid of all acronyms? Would Jesus have tried to hit on his apostles if he had had a blow dryer? It's worth checking out. And, you know, the thing about cults that really got me thinking is, in many ways, our society of materialism and capitalism is a cult. And it's why you see so many people go nuts when they get everything materially that they want, but they have no spiritual life. They have no goal outside of their own ego and their own power. And it's... You know, not that I'm against capitalism, but when that is someone's highest goal, is just the pursuit of capitalism at the expense of everything else. It's a people wind up acting like people do that lead cults. It becomes all about power and manipulation, and they can never, ever get enough. One of my favorite guests from the podcast is Jordan Harbinger, and he has a show oddly enough, called The Jordan Harbinger Show. Some really fascinating guests. You get some great people. And one of the guests you had is Dr. Jen Eberhard.
Yeah, Dr. Jennifer Eberhard is a researcher over at Stanford, and she's just brilliant. She actually did an experiment that shows that if you look like your standard issue sort of white dude, it takes people, regular people and police both, longer to see that you are armed and a threat. So they'll show like a photo of a white guy who looks like me with a gun, you know, in his waistband. It takes longer to detect that gun and to see that I'm a threat. And then if somebody is darker skinned and they are unarmed and not threatening, it takes longer for the brain to see that that person is not armed and not a threat. So that's just one of many things going on in the brain. And in this episode with her, 399 of the Jordan Harbinger Show, we talk about what's going on in the brain that creates and maintains bias, how bias can alter what we feel, can affect what we see, just like we talked about, and that bias is actually contagious. We've evolved bias. It's not necessarily the product of racism. It's an evolutionary thing, but it's actually something that we can share and give to others, which is kind of horrifying if you think about it.
Yeah, fascinating and depressing. Is that the quote you like to use for the Jordan Harbinger Show? Fascinating and depressing.
Yes, fascinating and depressing and horrifying all at the same time.
And that describes you personally.
Psychology Today. It does. Yeah, it's really a good fit. That's why I named it the Jordan Harbinger Show.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
One of our sponsors for today is BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. If you've never tried online therapy, I highly recommend it. I checked in with my therapist, Donna, this last week, and sometimes I don't realize what I'm going through until we start talking, because I have a way of numbing myself and just telling myself, oh, whatever it is that you're thinking about, you know, just push it off to the side. And I think I've been going through a little bit of a professional crisis and, you know, feeling like having trouble navigating what the next chapter of the podcast looks like. Am I achieving all the potential creative pursuits that I want to, or am I resting on my laurels, or am I being too hard on myself? And she really does a great job of helping me sort through all that stuff. So if you're interested in checking out it, I'll go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash metal part so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor they feel is a good fit for you, they'll pair you up with one. You can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's good thing for you. And you need to be over 18. And they are licensed in all 50 states. And you can get 10% off your first month. BetterHelp.com/mental. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Mere Muse. And she writes, my husband just told me in the car that he doesn't understand why I'm so upset this morning. We are driving to my dad's funeral.
Every little thing feels like the end of the world.
The darkness came so quickly.
I was so fucking angry.
Make me as close to dead as possible.
And I felt so powerless.
Without the commitment.
If there's a word for it,
unbearable.
It means somebody else felt this way.
The feeling is so intense.
It is a lot more work.
I was frightened all the time.
To feed a child's emotional world.
Everyone feels pain.
Than it is their superficial world.
Everyone suffers.
My sexual addiction was the shame.
My mom ended up killing that woman in front of me and my brothers.
I had to feel that shame in order to feel the pleasure.
And I was being a dick to everybody.
We are social beings.
And the only way you're going to get it out is to cry.
We need to be with people.
I grabbed them by their throats and led them down to the floor and watched the breath leave their bodies.
Maybe well, listen, thanks for coming in. I am here with Joe List, and he's a comedian. You're based out of New York, and Joe also has a podcast called Mindful Metal Jacket, and I just listened to the most recent episode with you and Ian Fidance.
Fidance, yeah.
Yeah. Really great, open, honest, vulnerable conversation about anxiety and meds and all kinds of other stuff. And your intro, I very much related to your self-flagellating and second-guessing of yourself. So welcome.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. I'm glad to be here. I love talking about all this stuff.
Where are you from originally, Joe?
I grew up in Massachusetts, Whitman, Massachusetts, which is south of about 35 minutes south of Boston, right next to Brockton, Massachusetts. Have you ever heard of Brockton, Massachusetts?
No. So you're just mildly racist.
Yeah, just a touch, just a little.
As you get further from Southie, then the racism begins to dissipate.
Yeah, exactly. That's how we try to do it. It's like a zoning thing.
Where's a good place to start? Let's talk about what it was like growing up as a kid. What was kind of the emotional vibe in your family and inside yourself?
Boy, we're just jumping right in here. My God.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard. It felt like everything feels normal when you're a kid and just, you know, looking back now, maybe it was very stressful, I guess. I've always felt really, really anxious and insecure and fearful ever since I can remember as a kid. But it also felt pretty uneventful relatively, which is what made me feel so something was wrong with me, because there was my parents were together. They weren't violent. There was no real violence in my life, and no real abuse, and no divorce, and no death. And so it felt pretty regular, suburban, you know, blue collar, you know, two kids, two adults, two parents. But my personal feeling was always that of fear and anxiety, certainly.
You're a sober guy. How long have you been sober?
I've been sober for about 7.5 years, a little more than 7.5. End of December will be 8 years.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Obviously, as you went to support groups, and I'm assuming that you go to support groups, some of the things that you mentioned that were in your inner life as a kid also overlap with the brain and the emotions of an untreated alcoholic. And so talk about when you started doing your self-discovery in support groups, what that was like.
Well, I don't know. It was sort of, that was very helpful to realize that fear had been sort of driving a lot of my decisions and choices and behavior, and the fear of fitting in, and fear of death and belonging, and wanting to be liked and people pleasing, all of those things that I wasn't aware of. And when I was actively drinking and you know, going kind of wild, I didn't realize, I thought everything was happening to me. I thought the world was against me, show business was against me, my friends were against me. I didn't realize how much of it I was creating on my own.
The typical piece of shit the world revolves around.
Exactly. Yeah. That's still my favorite thing to think about, is that ego and self-hatred coexisting at the same time, that I'm a piece of shit and every single person's talking about it right now.
Yeah, you know, it occurred to me one day that they're really both just two sides of the same coin, which is self-obsession. You know, anything to keep us thinking about ourselves. Doesn't matter whether we're the king or the pauper in our brain. It's just a way to become engrossed in self.
Yeah, completely. And that's the a thing I still struggle with now, even in sobriety and in meditation and in all that stuff. And I was just thinking about that the other day. I was, you know, even when I worry about the state of society and future generations with whatever politically or war or famine or climate change, it's still about me and affecting my personal
life. So funny. I so relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, there's people that are in disasters right now. I'm not even thinking about them. I'm like, oh my God, is New York City going to be underwater? Cause that's where I live.
Right. You know? When the Civil War bread line forms, how far at the back of the line do you picture yourself?
I picture myself the very last person just doing the over-the-shoulder look.
Yes.
And what is this?
Yeah. And are people actively trying to stab you while you're doing that?
I feel that way all the time. I think everyone's about to stab me 100% of the time.
When did anxiety start to become something that was unmanageable for you?
Unmanageable. It's hard. Like, I just, again, like, I didn't realize growing up, I think in the 80s and 90s, people didn't know as much or talk about it as much then. Nobody, it was a long, long time before someone was like, oh, you have anxiety or panic. I remember I was in my early 20s is when I first started having panic attacks, really serious panic attacks, almost daily for a while, where I would be on the ground shaking and, you know, I would shake really bad and I would have a hard time breathing and I'd have that kind of tunnel vision and it would be horrible. And I think I was 23 or 24 around that time when it started to get completely out of control. And I took going to therapy really helped that. But even then, the thing that helped me in therapy was someone going, you have panic, you're having panic attacks, and like giving me some, you know, a piece of paper that talked about panic attacks. And for me, going back to that self-centered thinking, I always felt like I was the only one experiencing things. I always say, I feel like I had Joe List disease. And once someone says, oh, that's this thing, you immediately feel relieved of it. Oh, okay. That's, I just have a thing that some people have. And so that helped. And of course it came back later.
And how did you deal with it after having that perspective that it wasn't Joe List disease?
Well, at first it was just, okay, it's anxiety, I'm not dying. Because that's what would happen when I was having anxiety attacks, is it felt like I was dying. I thought something was seriously wrong with me. And once it was like, no, there's nothing really seriously wrong with you, you're just having anxiety, that kind of helped it subside for a while. I would still have anxiety, but I wouldn't have panic. And yep. Then, of course, it came back again a few times later. And it would always come back in, but it wouldn't just be one panic attack. It would be a panic attack every day for a few weeks.
That sounds awesome.
It was horrendous. I mean, it was really scary. And most people don't have panic attacks like that. So right. No one knows really what you're talking about. Like, people would give me a paper bag to breathe in and my family was trying to be helpful, but they'd be like, let's think about baseball. You got a ball game coming up? Or, you know, let's think about what's fun to look forward to.
You're getting a nice workout, Joe. You're you're breaking into a sweat. That's good. You're flushing out toxins.
Yeah. Get that blood pumping. But people that don't know about it, it's hard to really help if you don't really know what's going on exactly. And people would say, yeah, you got to relax, and that would make it even worse. And at the time, I didn't realize that trying to stop a panic attack and stop anxiety is not helpful. It's the opposite. It just makes it worse. It makes you sink worse into those things.
Because you're still trying to control something that is largely out of your control rather than kind of moving, you know, with the flow of it and observing it.
Yeah. And I think it's all about acceptance. I've found everything that's helped me, therapy, support groups, you know, meditation, it all kind of comes back to accepting and letting go. And so that's the thing that finally helped me years later, and just a couple years ago, with anxiety and panic attack, is accepting that I'm having a panic attack and just letting go and going, oh, okay, this is anxiety. My hands are shaking. I have trouble breathing. And it sounds so counterintuitive, but sort of leaning into it, accepting it, understanding it, allows it to slow down and stop.
Are there things that trigger it?
Well, I haven't had one in a long time. There's certain things that trigger it. For me, it's the idea of, or the possibility of confrontation. Like, I'm a comedian, so if someone's on stage before me, my opener's on stage, and I can see somebody's drunk or heckling, or I'll start having an argument in my head and going, this is going to be an issue, this is going to be a problem. And that doesn't put me into panic anymore, but it puts me where a panic attack used to begin. I have the tools now to kind of understand that's just anxiety, but it sends me into that, the lowest level of where, if it was a chart, it would start going up. Any kind of confrontation can get me pretty anxious still.
Would you ever have a full-blown panic attack while you were on stage?
Yeah, I've had that a couple times.
What is that like, and how did was the audience aware?
I've had panic attacks on stage. I had one on television. I was doing a set on Conan, and I was having just horrible anxiety. And it was happened in a time period where I was having anxiety attacks pretty regularly, every few days and in certain situations. And what happens with anxiety and panic is you become afraid of where you might have the next one. So you start to go, oh my God, what if I'm on stage and I have a panic attack? What if I'm on TV and I have a panic attack? What if I'm so-and-so or wherever? You think of the worst place where you might have it, and that kind of triggers it. And I was having just horrible anxiety right as it was time for me to go on stage. And I had done a few late night spots before, and I was always afraid of that, but it had never happened. And this time it was happening. And the audience, I don't think anyone really noticed. And I was shaking and really scared, and I kind of fumbled a line, but I got through it. And it's funny because that actually helped me a lot. I had another one at the St. Louis Funny Bone. It was a Saturday night, sold out.
That's just common. That's just you making sense of the world. was this Westport? Well, I guess South County closed some years ago, so I assume it was the Westport Funny Bone.
It was Westport, yeah. And it was like a sold out, packed Saturday night, and it was horrible. It lasted almost the whole set. Where you start to go, you have this war with your brain where you're like, I think it's getting better, and the idea of thinking, oh, I think it's getting better, makes it worse again. It starts to come back.
It's almost like paying attention to a stalker.
Right, exactly. So what helped ultimately through therapy and having a panic attack on TV and at a show, it actually was the best thing that could have happened to me, because the show ended up being good. I still did well because I still was able to say all the jokes. And my therapist helped me because he's like, that's amazing. Your worst fear came true. The worst thing that could possibly happen is a panic attack on TV or while headlining, and it was fine. You were fine. And so that really took a lot of the teeth out of it, is you kind of have this thing of, okay, worst case scenario, I'll shake a bunch. I'll still be able to talk. I'll survive. And you realize, oh, it's just fear. All it is fear and thoughts, really. And it manifests physically in that I'm shaking, but that's all right. So I'm just shaking. You know, it's a little embarrassing for people to see your hands shaking so bad, but you know, they're still there.
So you clearly have not imagined somebody leaping out of the crowd and stabbing you.
You've
overlooked that possibility, yeah, which is very real.
Yeah, I've thought of that a few times, but that's, again, something I can't really do, but I do study jiu-jitsu and mixed martial arts to some degree, so maybe I'd be able to, you know, tap and have them not stab me.
And thank you for listening to The Art of Stabbing with Paul Gilmartin. I'm going to try to bring that up a third time before we wrap this up. What are actually, before we go to what the struggles are today, let's talk about the bottom that you hit before you decided, man, I need help for my drinking.
Well, I feel like I had a few. I had a few bottoms, and then I hung out at the bottom for a while.
Is there a cover charge at the bottom?
No, completely free. I mean, all you have to, it costs your dignity.
Yeah.
So the first time, I mean, when I finally got sober this time, it was just, you know, sick of tired of being sick and tired. Like, right. I had been drinking for a decade and my career was not doing well at all. I had no money and my relationships were kind of terrible. And the last sort of thing for me was weird. It doesn't sound all that crazy, because I have crazier drinking stories, war stories, but I kept drinking. But the last thing on this sobriety was I was looking forward to going home for Christmas back to Massachusetts, and I went home and every Christmas gift I got was alcohol. And I realized,
my God, that is fantastic.
It was just all boo. We got you Captain Morgan. Here's some nips and here's the thing. And I just thought, boy, this is wild. I'm just the drunk. I'm the alcoholic guy. And I was so depressed. And then one thing that happened was my brother-in-law, who I love, his father had just passed away a couple days earlier. And I made a couple cracks about it, thinking, hey, we're buddies. I was like, yeah, because your dad or something. And he just looked so sad and like empty and just disappointed. And he went, What are you doing, man? And I remember thinking, I don't know.
I'm avoiding and, feeling. What are you doing?
Yeah. It just felt like I remember just hurting somebody I really cared about and just hurting his feelings on Christmas and just going, yeah, I don't know. And it felt like this metaphorical thing where he's like, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. And then I thought, I got to quit. And it had been on my mind for years that I'm going to have to quit. And I had tried to quit before, and I had even gone, to support groups before, and it just didn't stick. I thought these people are nuts. I don't need this. And then I went back to New York and was like, I got to quit. And then of course I got, drunk that night and drank all night that night. And then my friend who doesn't drink, but he's not an alcoholic, he's never really drank, he gave me one of those online tests, you might be an alcoholic thing. And there's an old joke that if someone's giving you that test, you're an alcoholic, you don't even need the test. But, and then I got 26 out of 28 of those. And they were like, if you said yes to five, you might be an alcoholic. I'm like, geez, I fucking killed it. So, and then I had this conversation. I always talk about this because it's so funny to me. I was making a case of why I should keep drinking, and he was making a case why I should stop. And I said, all right, but I felt like I had checkmate. I said, what about when I'm at a bar or a party and I just hate everybody there, what do I do then? And he said, you go home. And it really was like this moment of like clarity where I'm like, I never even thought of that. I could just not be at a bar. And that was the next day. I was like, I kind of had this moment of like, that's it. I'm quitting drinking. And I made a list of everybody I knew that was sober. And I was lucky. My girlfriend, now wife at the time, she was an alcoholic in recovery already. We were together. I was out drinking still, and she was in recovery. And so that was really helpful. So I had somebody really close, and I had friends that were sober. And I'm a comedian, so half the comics are alcoholics. So that was helpful.
And that
for me.
May be a low ballpark figure.
Yeah, yeah. It's a large percentage. So I had friends, and what helped me was I didn't drink till I was out of high school, which was pretty late. And I had a great time in high school. I was very popular and an athlete, and I did well. And so I thought, I've lived like this before. And so that helped me be like, I'll just be that guy again. And so that was helpful. And then, it's the best thing that I've ever done.
How did your relationship change with your wife once you started going to support groups and, I'm assuming, doing some work on yourself and reexamining your perspective on life and how you interact with people?
Well, it was really helpful. I mean, first of all, she was thrilled that I wasn't going to be drinking anymore. And she never put it to me or an ultimatum or whatever like that. And even when I said I was quitting, she kind of went, oh, okay, great. We'll see about that. But she had said later that she's like, we weren't going to last much longer just because, I was pretty good at keeping drinking in our relationship separate. So, she would have to deal with me just kind of coming home drunk, but I was never a real, vicious drunk, fuck you, or any, I was always nice. It was just more insecure. I'd be like, you hate me. Everybody hates me. I was that kind of guy. And it wouldn't have lasted. We certainly wouldn't still be together now. I mean, I might be dead now, but the relationship improved immensely quickly because I started to see how self-centered I had been in a lot of situations. And also just, it's hard to even truly pay attention or be present in conversations and in relationships when you're drinking the way I was. And
self-obsessed, which, you know, as clearly you know, is one of the roots of untreated alcoholism. And it's funny because when we're in our untreated disease, we think that beating ourselves up or hating ourselves is some form of discipline that is making amends for our behavior with other people. And it's such a lazy, selfish way of, quote, doing something about our drinking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I always felt like I would just say to everybody, I'm a piece of shit. I'm the worst. And it did. It felt like that was somehow helping or making people. I'm like, if I let them know that I realize I'm a bad person or I did something bad, then that's fine. That's enough. And that's, you know, obviously not the case, but it made sense in my head.
What are the struggles today?
Today it's still, I still have anxiety. I don't have panic like I did before, but certainly anxiety is something I still deal with, and believing my thoughts, that's, and future tripping. I do a lot of that and get caught in a loop of, oh my God, I'm not gonna be able to do this. And thinking I'm not going to be able to handle things, and just my mind gets, out of control easily. And basically it's just believing my thoughts. And I have this little mantra. I say, fear is just fear and my thoughts are not reality. And that helps. And certainly meditation, but also slipping back into that self-centered thinking. And I have to go, oh, I'm just thinking about me. And that's why I'm dealing with this. My friend, Jack, has a great thing that really helps me. He said, anytime I'm suffering, if I'm really angry or upset or mad or bitter or resentful, I ask myself, what am I trying to control? And that is really helpful to me, because that's what it really is I'm trying to control something that I can't control, whether it be society or the weather or somebody's feelings to me or somebody's reaction to something I've done or said, or financial, whatever it is. So that's definitely a struggle. I can go into dark places still, or be, you know, just to be self-centered asshole, and I gotta be mindful of those things.
It's almost like throwing a reality tantrum.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, one of the litmus tests for me, or the barometers of how I'm doing spiritually, is how I react in traffic. You know, do I take it personally that road construction is, you know, at a shitty time of the day, in my opinion, or whatever. And most of the time I can just go, you know, it's not personal. Maybe the universe needs me to be a half hour late, or, you know, that person that's driving erratically, maybe they need to get in an accident to wake up and see that they're filled with fear and, you know, whatever. But it's ultimately none of my business. It's just how I conduct myself that really matters. But it's so hard in that moment when the rage just fills your face and it's red hot and you just want to teach that person a lesson.
Yeah. And the hard part is it feels good. I mean, that's what's weird is going into those places strangely feels good. Again, it's like, it's counterintuitive to be accepting and peaceful. My natural thing is to be like, yeah, I knew this. I hope for someone to upset me so I can be angry at them. It feels good to go, that son of a, and
the gasoline that Facebook runs on.
Yeah, exactly. Our whole society seems to be running on it these days. So, yeah, staying away from those things is really, and getting outside of my head and thinking about other people is really a challenge, but that's the best way for me to be and live.
So are you making your living as a podcaster or as a stand-up comedian or both?
Well, right now through COVID, I mean, it's both. There's some gigs now. I'm doing
pre-COVID.
Pre-COVID was more, it was a combination, but stand-up more than podcasting. And now post-COVID, it's more podcasting than stand-up because I'm still not doing indoor shows. A lot of people are. I just haven't done that yet. But there's a bunch of great outdoor shows, but I'm in New York, so those are starting to slow down a little bit. But it's a little bit, I almost said COVID. That's on my mind. It's a little bit podcast and a little bit stand up. I'm making zero money from COVID, but yeah, mostly podcasts these days.
Talk about what it felt like when the quarantine was put into effect, the stand up comic in you. Because I would imagine, because sometimes I stopped doing stand up 10 years ago or 9 years ago. And sometimes I picture what it would be like if the bulk of my income was from doing that and suddenly I couldn't do it.
Yeah, it was scary. I mean, I felt so grateful to have a podcast that was making some money and I had some savings, which was nice. It was scary. I mean, like, it was definitely anxiety inducing, but I did have my, again, like being sort of actively sober and a meditator in therapy, all of those tools helped a lot. And it was strangely like, oh, this is what I've been training for.
Right. Yeah.
It was kind of like, okay, it's one day at a time. Let me try to control what I can control, accept, and let me see. There's people certainly doing worse than me. I should try to reach out to them and help them in any way. So that was helpful. And strangely, there was something strangely nice about it in a way. And I feel bad because I know people's lives have been destroyed because of this stuff. But
enough about them.
But who cares about them? But I was on the road. I'm a road dog. So I'm on the road 40, 45 weeks a year. And September through December, I did every week, like 16 weeks in a row, gone for four, home for 3 days, back out for 3 days. And so my schedule coming up in the end of March and April, I was leaving my house for 22 days. I was going to Australia, LA, Austin, Boston, Vegas, maybe one other city, or maybe it was those. But so that was, I was dreading it. I was like, I can't believe I'm going to be, oh my God, these flights. And so it was sort of strange to have a nice break from that and a break from the stress of trying to come up with material and dealing with hecklers and dealing with travel and getting off and on planes. And part of it really helped me to kind of settle down my life mentally and physically. So there was some nice things about it, but also the feeling of out of control of how deadly is this? How are my parents going to be okay? What's going to be financially, what's going to happen? There was so much unknown about it, obviously. I mean, there's still quite a bit that's unknown, but it was pretty scary. And I'm in New York and in Queens, and that was where it was the worst. So that was nerve-wracking.
That must have been terrifying being in Queens.
Yeah, there was definitely, I mean,
I just mean in general.
Yeah, it's, I mean, in general, it's, I'm in a pretty nice neighborhood, but, no, there was definitely moments where I was like, this is we're just going to get it. I mean, I definitely remember thinking like, we'll have it. And then we had chicken soup and oatmeal and the whole thing. And slowly it felt like Wizard of Oz, where you slowly start coming out of, you know, the, wherever you're hiding and be like, I think this is all right, actually.
So, other than the anxiety, what are some of the struggles today?
I mean, outside of anxiety, I'm not sure there are any. I mean, I feel like my problems are all anxiety and mentally and created. I mean, it's a little hard with stand-up trying to figure out the right thing to do. Should I do indoor shows? Should I not do outdoor? Again, this basically is anxiety again. And figuring out the best way to make a living while trying to be, you know, safe and not putting other people in danger. But I don't know. I do feel like most of my issues and most people's issues are all mental related. I mean, I understand people. I am fortunate to have a podcast that makes money and I've done some stand-up. So that's not too big of a concern, but it is mostly anxiety related. I hate to make it sound like I'm just killing it here and I'm on top of the world. But for the moment, I mean, I guess I feel we're doing a mental health podcast. So I feel
It does not sound like you're bragging, Joe. It sounds like you're saying, hey, I worked to develop these tools and I got put in the game and I'm using them. And reality's rough, but I'm coping.
Yeah, thank you. You worded it much better than I could. I was really backpedaling there. But no, I mean, I feel good. I do feel grateful. I'm like, I have my health. My wife and I get along well. And I know a lot of people don't. And we don't have a kid to worry about here or anything. So it really is just sort of one day at a time and trying to do the best work I can do wherever I can do it safely.
What is it like doing stand up with the country being so divided politically, either for you or friends of yours? Do you have any kind of snapshots you can paint for me of what it's like out there as a stand up comic with the country so divided?
It's weird. I mean, I don't do, as far as stand up, I don't really do anything, certainly not overtly political. But these days it is weird. I mean, people are just feel like they're trying to find out any angle on how you vote, who you are, what you're thinking. And people on both sides are on high alert for any kind of buzzword or virtue signal of, wait, I think that sounded like he might be Trump. So it is like a thing of like, or vice versa, you know? So I try to, I mean, I walk out and I'm a skinny guy with glasses from New York. So people assume I'm a liberal, and then I say whatever thing that might not be PC, and people are like, wait a minute, you know? So it does, but that's also, again, anxiety. Maybe a lot of people aren't thinking that. Some certainly are. So that's on my mind immediately. I'm like, do people hate me for being white, or do people hate me for being a liberal? I mean, it is in my mind of which these all people all hate me. And again, that comes back to that self-centered anxiety. I always assume everybody hates me in general.
Until proven otherwise.
Exactly. So, and even then I'm still like, I don't know. I think you're full of shit. I think my wife likes me, but I'm not sure. But that is definitely nerve wracking, and people are wondering if you're going to say something political or politically. And I get people thanking me after shows for like, thanks for not mentioning Trump. We don't even want to, and even people that, you know, hate Trump don't want to hear about Trump. People just don't want to hear about, you know, that stuff anymore, I think. So I get compliments sometimes for people. Thanks for not talking politics. We appreciate it. And if you do mention anything political, people go, I liked everything except that one thing you said. And you're like, what? That was about grocery stores or something. Yes.
Have any of your fellow comics had stories or, you know, incidents that were like, brutal?
Yeah, I mean, brutal, I don't know, but there's definitely people can be passive aggressive after the show or try to tell you what's what. I don't know anyone that's had anything too serious that comes to mind, but there's definitely stories out there, but I don't have them off the top of my head. But I know it can get dicey for sure.
Any like during the show, or is it mostly after the show?
I think it's usually after the show, I feel like, hanging around, or, you know, maybe someone yells something out or whatever. I mean, I had a guy at a show in Texas, and he had, you know, the camouflage hat and cut off, you know, MAGA shirt in the front row, but he loved it. You know, he was loving it. And so it feels like, oh God, is this going to be an issue? This guy looks crazy. But, you know, for me anyways, I stick to just my material, and he loved it. So I don't know anyone that's had any really serious issues, but there's definitely, you feel the threat for sure. Yeah. And again, from both sides. But I did, now that I think about it, I'm like, there was a guy recently, I told this story on my podcast. There's a guy who did sort of some really irreverent stuff at a place out in Brooklyn. And, you know, he said whatever, he was making race jokes and gay jokes, and it started to get pretty,
hostile.
Pretty hairy. Yeah, hostile. Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of like, get him off the stage, this guy sucks. And I think he might have gotten banned from the venue. I mean, that one, but that was fun to me because I know him and I know what he does, and I knew the crowd, so I enjoyed the hell out of it. I'm like, this is gonna be fun.
Yeah, comics love watching each other bomb. Not on something important like TV or stuff like that, but watching a friend bomb at a one-nighter is a belly laugh that almost hurts.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah, when you see someone going down, I mean, it's really, really fun. And especially if it's, like you said, it's low stakes, and you know it's not their fault. It's not that they're bad. They're not failing. The situation is just terrible, and so you're like, this is great.
Anything else you'd like to talk about before we wrap up?
I don't know. I mean, I feel good just talking about this stuff, because it's funny, just saying it out loud helps me so much, because it reminds me of to do these things. It's so much, I'm always so much better when someone else is dealing with anxiety or is an alcoholic or whatever, because you can go, oh, I know how to handle this. And then it's so clear to you. But when it's you, you just lose your mind. So even just having the conversation is so helpful to me.
Well, that's awesome. People can find your podcast, Mindful Metal Jacket, and any other social media or YouTube stuff you want to share with them.
Yeah, I got a comedy special on YouTube. It's called I Hate Myself, ironically, or not ironically. It's called I Hate Myself, and it's YouTube. It's an hour special, and I'm really proud of it. We shot it right before everything shut down. March 2nd was when we recorded it, and it just came out a couple months ago, and it's got over 1 million views. So.
Oh, dude, congrats. That's awesome, man.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm pumped.
Well, Joe, thanks for making time and sharing all that stuff. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Probably a good thing that we recorded that before the election, because I think we might have gone down the rabbit hole of anxiety and existential dread. Many, many thanks to Joe. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
If you guys haven't subscribed to this podcast, that's a really great way to help us non-financially. It doesn't cost you anything. There's all different kinds of ways you can support the podcast. If you go to our donate page on our website, metalpod.com, you can find out different ways to support it, because we can always use more support. Let's dive into some surveys. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself, if I don't come up with a witty name, I'm afraid my survey won't get paid attention to. She writes, I rarely get nightmares. I just woke up from a nightmare where my mom was bullying me about my views on politics and parenting. In the dream, she was trying to manipulate me and even attempted to use my own kids against me. With every new nightmare scenario, my brain concocted about how my mother could attempt to manipulate me and cause me to react poorly, my dream self responded with an impressive amount of self-control, firm boundaries, and compassion for my mother. Not sure if this counts as awfulsome, as awesome, or if it just means I'm only recovering, quote, in my dreams, LOL. I think it's a good sign. I think it's a good sign. My girlfriend had a dream the other night that she had amnesia, and there were
all kinds of bloody towels around her, and she had the feeling that she had killed somebody, but didn't know what had happened. And she said that I was telling her, it's okay, don't worry about it, have compassion for yourself, and it made her feel better. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Jane. She writes, today I had an experience which simultaneously made me chuckle and made my blood boil. I struggle with body dysmorphia, social anxiety, and depression, which have hugely impacted my self-esteem and self-worth over the years. I can honestly say listening to your podcast has made a huge difference in my life and helped me to accept the parts of me that I don't like while holding my head high and embracing the strengths that I have. Well, thank you. I love hearing that. So I finally managed to find a job that suits me and I feel is the perfect amount of challenging and rewarding. I work as a support person for teens who have come out of the care system and are transitioning to adulthood and independent living. I can relate to some of their struggles and I love and admire their resilience and honesty. Anywho, this morning I was making the 45-minute walk to the train station on my way to work. I'm trying to limit my time on public transport, plus I find the walk clears my head. The streets were eerily quiet in my city in Ireland, where we have a lockdown due to the pandemic and only, quote, essential services are operating. I was wheeling my bright yellow mini suitcase along the cobblestone street. I'm working 4 days in a row and sleeping over where I work. From across the street, an elderly lady with a shopping basket shouts over to me, enjoy your staycation. Her tone was sarcastic, and so I stopped in my tracks. I said, actually, I'm on my way to work. I'm a social care worker. She rolled her eyes, muttering something under her breath, and kept walking. I shouted after her, not aggressively, but loud enough so that she could hear me. There's no need for that. You shouldn't make assumptions about people. I was fuming on the one hand that this total stranger had felt the need to cast aspersions on me, assuming I was ignoring the travel restrictions and having a leisurely vacation in the midst of the pandemic. On the other hand, I laughed at the audacity of this old lady who was bold enough to voice her opinions of her perceived wrongdoing. Mainly, I was proud of myself for speaking my mind and asserting my position. It was the first time ever I can think of that I felt confident or valid enough to take up space in this world and give the old biddy as much attitude as she gave me. I laughed to myself and rolled on down the hill. Thanks for doing the amazing work that you're doing, Paul. Stay safe, Jane. Thank you for that, Jane. I love the picture you painted, too, of the cobblestone street in Ireland. God, I just love when you guys fill out a survey and it just transports me to a place other than my stinky bedroom. This is a happy moment filled out by Elle, and she writes, waking up and hearing my baby singing to himself. It's so innocent and pure and adorable that even at 5 a.m., I'm okay with dragging myself out of bed. He always greets me with a huge smile and makes weird monkey noises when he sees me. I pick him up and cuddle with him on the bed for as long as he will let me, usually about 10 seconds, before he crawls away. Oh, that is so adorable. This is a happy moment filled out by Emerson Jacob, who is trans non-binary, and they write, my happiest moment of my life was the 5 to 6 month high I rode after having top surgery. I knew I needed it, but I was not prepared for just how much I needed it. Like walking out of a bar and realizing the music was so loud you can't hear. Except it was walking out of the 22 years of body dysmorphia and realizing you thought it was normal. It was a literal and figurative weight off my chest, 10 pounds. I felt like I could finally breathe. The amount of euphoria and bliss I experienced was like nothing I'd ever felt before. It was the first time in my life that I felt like me. In some ways, it hasn't worn off. I still smile every time I see my scars on my chest and I'm reminded of my journey. I get giddy with excitement when I get a chance to show off my awesome designer chest. Maybe it will wear off eventually, but I hope it never does. I hope I never get tired of seeing my authentic self. Thank you for that. That is just beautiful. There is something so pure and just so great about finding more authenticity in ourselves or seeing it in somebody else. In my support group, sometimes somebody will do some deep inner work just over the course of a couple of days or a week, and they'll come in to our meeting and there's a light on in their eyes. They're able to make eye contact. It's amazing. Amazing to see. I never get tired of it. This is from the love survey filled out by Pax, and they write, "When I get anxious, I pace around the house. When I get into these moods, it feels like I'm frantically treading deep water in darkness. The beacon that grounds me is my dog. I love it when I look down and see she's following me, tail wagging because she thinks we're playing a game, panting because she was following me the entire time. I love her." Oh, thank God for Gracie. Thank God for Gracie. She is, there must be 20 times a day when I just the feelings of fear and dread and catastrophizing just overwhelm me. And I just have to call her into the room and cuddle up on the couch with her and kiss her for 5 minutes. And then I always feel better. This is a happy moment filled out by Gav. And she writes, "This past 7 years of my life have been hard. As time went by, life became unbearable. In an effort to resolve this, at the start of this year, I gave myself a deadline. If my condition doesn't improve over the next 3 years, I will end my life. I started with self-help suggestions. Eating healthier helped me function, but it wasn't enough to function effectively. Exercising helped prevent stress, but it wasn't enough to help me sleep soundly. Socializing helped me maintain good relationships, but it wasn't enough to lift my spirits. Working a job I'm passionate about helped me find meaning, but it wasn't enough to keep me alive. At a loss, I sought professional help. A few GPs eliminated some common physical causes of my symptoms, but I failed to work with them for long enough to find a cause and treatment. A few psychologists helped to educate me on the details of my condition and guide me through self-help suggestions, but I failed to connect with them enough to admit I was still struggling. A psychologist with whom I found a strong professional rapport helped me feel supported, but it wasn't enough to keep me afloat. A new diet, carefully monitored by specialists, helped improve my gastrointestinal comfort, but it wasn't enough to increase my energy levels or improve my blood test results. And finally, a kind and empathetic GP, and in an enormous stroke of that GP's professional experience and luck, the second antidepressant we tried, I'm not even one-third of the way to my deadline, and my condition has improved far beyond what I had imagined for the first time in 7 years. I feel normal. My blood test results are normal. My psychological test results are normal. All the actions I took pushed me closer to the one thing that pushed me into normalcy. It wasn't quite enough to reverse my acceptance of death should it come to me, but it was enough so that I won't be seeking death as a final treatment, nor will I be content to accept death if I have any strength left to fight it. I can now honestly say I'm happy to be alive, and I intend to keep it that way if death doesn't take me sooner. I plan to celebrate my continuing life in 3 years' time. Please feel free to join me." Oh, thank you for that. Thank you for that. And what I love about this is just your dogged determination to keep seeking. That is one of the greatest gifts that we can be given by the universe is to be a seeker. It's so easy when we're depressed and or numb to just endure day after day after day, hoping that things change without trying anything to make things change. And, you know, part of what sucks about that is when we do put effort into things that we hope are going to make the difference and they don't. But what I found is that when I do take those steps, you know, be it exercise or diet or therapy or psychiatrist or 900 different meds, is that at least I can say to myself, okay, I'm doing my part. The rest is up to the universe. So at least that one voice in my head that tells me I'm lazy and I'm not doing anything, at least that is quiet. So the doom can have the floor. This is from the love survey filled out by William, and he writes, I love looking at a basket full of laundry that I've managed to sit down and fold. It's simple, but it proves to me that I do have some self-control and order somewhere in my life. That's a great one. Thanks for that, William. This is from the loves survey filled out by Jay Chrism, and they write, The moment when coming home from a long day at work, seeing my cats at the top of the stairs, hearing them meow, telling me it's time to feed them, knowing I'm working for them, keeps me going and motivated. Walking into my room, and when pulling a blanket onto myself, still able to smell the scent of a candle I'd lit earlier, only to have the smell remain in the sheets of my bed. Driving home from work in my car alone, able to blare whatever music I want and just talk to myself. Fear of judgment and just a moment to express myself freely. Thank you for that. This is from the love survey filled out by Kat. She writes, nervous poos. Being nervous sucks, but the giant poop you take is too cleansing not to appreciate. That's a great one. This is from the love survey filled out by Mermaid Hair, and she writes, I love having long, wavy, curly hair. For a long time, I hated it, but now it's my favorite part of my body. I love how it feels underwater when it's soft and silky and weightlessly flowing behind me. I love the gentle pull of a comb through long, wet, perfectly untangled hair. Thank you for that. I've always kind of thought to myself, I don't know if always is the right word, but often thought to myself, man, what if I just let my hair grow out? What would that look like? But I don't know, there's that kind of ugly in-between stage. I don't know. This is from the love survey filled out by Natalie. She writes, I love when my dog Francie climbs halfway up the couch next to me and looks at me with her sad lab eyes and won't move until I've hugged her for several minutes. I love when I look out my bedroom window and I can see the chickens watching me and listening to my conversations as if they were watching the monkeys at the zoo. I love when my other dog, Jacques, farts super loud and it sounds like when you squeeze the end of a balloon and let the air out. And I love it when my boyfriend rolls over and hugs me super tight in his sleep. Oh, those are great. Thank you for those. And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by, I think it's a happy moment filled out by a woman who calls herself a mentally ill social worker. And she writes, I spent much of 2017 and 2018 in psychiatric hospitals. And I guess it would be an awfulsome moment in a residential treatment center. The psych ward became my second home. I was there so much that my phone thought my local hospital was my actual home. After a lot of hard work, the right medications, support groups, and surrounding myself with supportive people, I was able to recover. A big piece of my recovery was finding a new job in my field and getting back to doing what I love. I'm a social worker. Recently, one of my clients was psychiatrically hospitalized, and today there was a meeting at the hospital. It occurred to me as I walked through the all-too-familiar locked doors that this was the first time I'd been in a psych ward in months, and even better, I wasn't the patient. I've come to a place in my recovery where I can genuinely help other people again. I'm so thankful for the providers I worked with, and I hope my work is a way for me to give back to the system that brought me out of the depths. Oh, man, that is so much good stuff in there, especially the meaning and purpose that you found in taking what was tragic and painful for you and using it to bring yourself a sense of purpose and to help people around you. And that's one of the things that's so great about recovery and support groups is, you know, we roll in there just wanting to not die. And then we come to find all of these great byproducts that we could never imagine that make life feel so different. Yeah. Oh, man. I don't know what to say about what's going on right now, and I'm not gonna, because I'm gonna probably go off on an angry tirade, and I don't want to be that person. Because I deep down, I'm scared. I'm scared that that the catastrophizer in my brain is actually accurate, and it's only a matter of time until the armed hordes are knocking at the door and taking all my canned goods. And oh my God, I need to go put my virtual reality goggles on and shoot some zombies. So if you're out there and you're feeling stuck, oh my God, you're so not alone. This is such an important time for us to be kind to ourselves and just to try to find the love wherever it is, and to not demonize other people, because I am finding myself doing that all the time, just filling myself with temporary hate and resentment, and it's like a bad drug high. And it's not healthy. So all of that is to say, good luck to you. God bless. But you're not alone, and thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.